This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hey, hey, folks. Welcome to the Man of Steel. This is Michael Steele. Yes, this is the Man of Steel podcast. And a lot of good stuff happening out there we want to get into today. We've got a real good good guy on board that's going to help us dissect and understand exactly what the hell we saw happen this week across the country with the vote. And that little bit of a dramatized press conference yesterday, help us kind of figure it out. The one and only, you got to know him, you got to love him. Max Boot is a historian, best-selling author, foreign policy analyst, and when he's not busy doing that stuff, he's a columnist for the Washington Post. He's got this great book out. We highly recommend you pick it up, The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. Max Boot, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast, brother. Good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be on.
So Max, there was this little thing called an election on Tuesday, and apparently a lot more people showed up than people thought would show up, number one. And they sent a message, I thought. In fact, as I looked at the election going into it and trying to dissect exactly what I thought it would be and how it should play out, but more importantly, what people should be looking at, I focused on two questions. One, what kind of country do you want? And two, what kind of leaders you want to run that country? And it seemed to me, at least, Republicans, Democrats, independents, citizens started to answer that question a little bit. You think?
I think they did, although I would say, Michael, that the answers were sometimes contradictory and a mixed message.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, as somebody who is a never Trump conservative like you, I was heartened to see what happened with the races in the House of Representatives, where there was a real rebuke to Republicans who joined with Trump in trafficking in racism, xenophobia, hate mongering, conspiracy mongering, all those characteristics that we saw play out, especially in the last few weeks of the campaign. And of course, Democrats won the majority, Republicans lost the majority. And so that's what I was hoping to see would happen. But on the other hand, I have to admit, I mean, deplorable as this might be, Donald Trump's tactics did seem to work mm-hmm. in some Senate races and some yeah. gubernatorial races in places like Georgia and Florida, where, you know, he did help Republicans to pull out victories. And unfortunately, I think the consequence of that is going to be that the Republican Party is tethered more closely than ever before to Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, and that's a very interesting point, because what you saw in many respects was the suburbs defect from the president. So you had those center right, center left individuals, independent types, move away from the Trumpism that they bought into in the 2016 election. But that base held, and that base held largely because the president in the last 10 days or so really doubled down on those elements of his campaign and his presidency that he thinks works: the racism, the xenophobia, the sense of other coming to get you and take from you, your land, your property, your country, or whatever. Why was that? Why is that base really that locked in? And with the suburbs behaving the way they did, what does that tell you about the future? I mean, you're talking about a country that's roughly a 40-60 split in many respects, but I kind of think there may be a little bit more to that other side than we like to acknowledge. That number may be closer to 50-50 as opposed to 40-60.
I think it depends on the election and on the candidate. I mean, I think it was really a good news, bad news story because, as you say, the suburbs did reject a lot of this Republican hate mongering. I think it really backfired for Trump in those districts and cost the Republicans the majority. But again, in a lot of the red states, this kind of hysteria about the caravan was embraced. And by the way, fascinating how as soon as the election happens, Fox News and Donald Trump stopped talking about the caravan. The military,
wasn't that funny?
Yeah, the military rescinds their. They had this Operation Faithful Patriot, and whoops, on Tuesday, that's not it anymore. There's no more operation. Never mind. You can go about your lives. You're not going to be, raped and robbed by this caravan of invaders.
I love it. Yeah, that was the one thing, and it's so funny because you didn't hear a peep about caravan at 12:01 a.m. It was like no one ever had the conversation. But it says a lot about how gullible folks are, too, and how desperate they are to believe something to fulfill a narrative that they've either written in their own mind or think really exists out there. And the president has been successful at playing that up. And I think he did a lot of that to sort of solidify not his congressional base vote, because I don't think he gave a damn about them. He doesn't care if we lose the House. I think he saw the Senate as his wall. He needed to have that Senate in place because Lord knows what could come down the pike where he's going to need the Senate, especially with respect to Mueller. But there's also, we've got Supreme Court nominations, and of course, when, you know, Justice Ginsburg had her fall, I mean, a lot of people were like, oh my God, get her some bubble wrap, you know?
It's right, like, right.
No, you need to just sit down and stay still, you know, because potential appointments down the road. So the president, I think, sort of looked at this election not so much, certainly not the way the Republican leadership did, like the NRCC. They're out there trying to, you know, get Republicans elected to the House. He saw it more as, I don't care who's in the House. My transaction is with the Senate, particularly when you look at where he went with those 11 visits. They weren't in battleground districts. They weren't in places where the president probably could have helped some Republicans keep their seat. But rather in states where he really needed to shore up the Senate either to take a Senate seat, like in North Dakota, or to shore up a Senate seat somewhere else.
Yeah, and he got his firewall, no question about it. I mean, I thought that the chances of a successful impeachment in the Senate were remote before, and now they're just astronomically remote because there's a larger Republican majority, and I think they feel more tethered than ever before to Donald Trump. I admit to being a little bit disappointed with the results, although there were aspects of it that I appreciated. I mean, I'm very happy to see that there will be some accountability and pushback in the House, and I think that's especially important in terms of the Mueller and trying to protect his investigation. But, you know, there was no change in the linkage between Donald Trump and the Republican Party. I mean, they've become completely synonymous. And I think the election ratified that marriage. And so this is really not the Republican Party anymore. It's the Trump Party. And, you know, I hope people are happy with that.
Yeah. And I want to get into that in a little bit and sort of peel that onion back. And we can both have a good cry about what happened to the party that we joined many years ago and how it so easily, so readily capitulated to the fraud that was perpetrated on them. But we'll hold that thought. I want to finish up on the midterms and get your thoughts on this idea of the year of the woman and how that narrative played out and how Republicans found themselves largely on the side of the road. And particularly when you look at the case of Mia Love and her losing her seat in Utah, the only black female Republican in the United States Congress, it appeared to me there wasn't even a real effort to protect her. You know, I tracked that race a little bit. And, you know, the president made mention of, oh, yeah, she would call me for help on some issues. But there was no real sense that folks were really kind of rallying around to sort of shore themselves up against these Democratic women that were looking to come to Congress. A significant number of them now are going to be coming. What's your take on that piece of this midterm narrative?
Well, I think you're right. And of course, Trump was as classless as ever in basically gloating over the loss of people like Mia Love. You know, he was saying she didn't show me any love, so she lost. So he is basically suggesting that it was the Republicans who were insufficiently loyal to him that paid the price, whereas in fact, obviously, it was the Republicans in the swing districts where the voters had a decided revulsion against Donald Trump, and they took that out on representatives like Mia Love. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me because I'm seeing like a lot of people on Twitter blaming me and Tom Nichols and other Never Trump conservatives because we urged voters to support Democrats as a check on Donald Trump. And right. So now all these right-wingers on Twitter are saying it's your fault that, you know, Carlos Curbelo lost or Mia Love or some of these other moderate Republicans. And, you know, obviously, if I were king of the world here and I had my druthers, I would say, yeah, I would rather keep Mia Love and get rid of Steve King. But, right. You know, I can't control that transaction. And the reality is that the most Trumpy members of Congress are the ones in the safest seat. So you can't dislodge them with explosives. There's no way to get them out of those seats. And so the ones who are going to pay the price for what Donald Trump does is unfortunately going to be the more moderate elements of the Republican Party, like Mia Love. And it's unfortunate, but there's just nothing you can do about that because if the Mia Loves are winning, that means Republicans are going to keep their majority and there's going to be no check whatsoever on Donald Trump.
Right. So on that point, why wasn't the blue wave bigger? I mean, I didn't think the wave was going to really be a wave. I thought it'd be more like, a relatively good high tide.
Surfing time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but not this kind of like tsunami. You know, it wasn't that kind of deal. What's your appreciation of that part of the narrative about that? Certainly coming from Democrats who were also hopeful, only to be deflated at the loss of Beto O'Rourke and Gillum and others. It sort of dissipated before it sort of, you know. I guess, what's the word? What do waves do? They sort of break? Yeah, it broke before it got to shore. What do you think happened?
Well, I mean, you can look at it two ways. One, you can say it dissipated. It wasn't what people had hoped for. And I think that's probably true to some extent. But it was still fairly significant. It's going to be over 30 seats, which, as people are pointing out, is the largest Democratic pickup since the Watergate class of 1974. Right. I mean, I think it looks disappointing because it's not like 2010 where Republicans picked up, you know, over 60 seats.
Yeah, we did a good job
in that tsunami against President Obama. But I mean, keep in mind also very different economic times. I mean,
yes.
In 2010,
yes,
we were coming out of the worst recession in decades, or trying to recover from the worst recession in decades. And now, I mean, as Trump keeps bragging, this is the greatest economy ever. So, you know, the fact that the House Republicans are still losing so many seats, even at such boom economic times, I think does reflect a disgust with President Trump.
Right. No, I think you're right about that. And it's one of those things where I think the Democrats, I go back to 2010 and I look at what we did. And the one thing that I think helped make a difference for a lot of candidates that while they each had their own storylines in their respective states, whether they were running for Congress or governor or sheriff. We did have an overarching conversation that we were having with the country about the role of government. How big should it be? Should it nationalize our health care? And if it does, what does that look like? And how do people pay? And how do they get, you know, how do you engage in that conversation on those subjects? And we related it. In this case, and I heard a lot of Democrats sort of bragging about the fact that, well, we leave our candidates to go out and make their own argument to the community. And there's value to that. But if you also, I think, have to connect those communities one to the other. So there is an animating principle behind this whole push, this whole conversation that they restarted on healthcare and pre-existing conditions. It really wasn't tethered to anything. And just as the Republicans weren't talking about the economy, the growth of the economy and the tax cuts and the Supreme Court appointments and the good things that they could arguably go out and say, Democrats were likewise not really making a national conversation around some broad ideas. You heard a lot of, you know, groaning about Trump, but there was no real connective tissue between what they were saying in the community and what a Democratic Party would look like writ large once they got the House or they got the Senate and they won these governorships. Did that really matter for you, or is that, am I just being too much of a party chairman?
No, I mean, I think that's a smart observation. I mean, it was kind of a strange campaign from my perspective because, as you say, the Republicans were not running on their economic accomplishments, which they could certainly tout. Instead, it was this campaign of fear and hate mongering, exactly the same way that Donald Trump got elected in 2016. And you have to wonder, I mean, how much longer can the actual incumbent run on everything is going to hell in a handbasket, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, isn't he responsible? I mean, if he's complaining that there's so many illegal immigrants, isn't he the president?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Although the caravan of 10-year-olds, I think, was... It was just one of those visuals. You're like, Mr. President, that's not going to work.
Well, it was so crazy, too, because, I mean, people have no short-term memory. They forget we had another caravan in April, and we survived that. It did not result in, you know, the overrunning of America. And it's the same phony issue resurrected from earlier in the year. And then on the other hand, you had the Democrats, as you were suggesting, they were really running on endorsing Obamacare, endorsing protections for pre-existing conditions, and that actually seemed to be a fairly smart play in the House races, but it kind of felt like they were ignoring the elephant in the room and not talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and the fact of it is they left a lot of good opportunities on the table, at least the Democrats did, which could have made their night even more special. But that was the election. And after the election, the president decided, I guess as all presidents do, to come and talk to the nation about what happened the night before. So the president has this press conference, which turned into this spectacular reality TV nightmarish version of itself, where the president went after CNN reporter Mr. Acosta for any number of violations that he wanted to impugn Jim Acosta with. Let's take a quick listen to some of that wonderful sound from the president and Jim Acosta of CNN.
In the midterms.
Here we go.
That this caravan was an invasion. As you know, Mr. President,
I consider it to be an invasion.
As you know, Mr. President, caravan was not an invasion. It's a group of migrants moving up from Central America towards the border with the U.S.
Thank you for telling me that.
And why did you characterize it as such?
Because I consider it an invasion. You and I have a difference of opinion.
But do you think that you demonized immigrants in this election?
No, not
to
at
try
all.
I
want them to come into the country, but they have to come in legally. You know, they have to come in, Jim, through a process. I want it to be a process. And I want people to come in, and we need the people. You know why we need the people, don't you? Because we have hundreds of companies moving in. We need the people.
Right. They're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's
not
an invasion.
Honestly, you know what?
Miles away. That's not an invasion.
Honestly, I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be
much
better.
Mr. President, I had one other question on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that... That you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts his butt.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either.
So, Max, what the hell was that? You got this peevish president. Okay, so here's how I looked at that moment. I'm sitting there and I'm watching the president, and my jaw started to go slack a little bit. I was like one of those, oh my God. And then I stopped and I went, wait a minute, hold up. You called on him. So clearly you wanted to pick this fight. You didn't have to call on Jim Acosta. If you hate CNN so much, if you can't stand what they say about you, why the hell would you call on him? You called on him because you wanted to pick a fight. You wanted to throw up a bright, shining object that you knew folks would chase down that ever-loving rabbit hole.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And, of course, the kind of tone of that press conference contradicted Trump's phony message up front about how this was a great victory. Well, if it was a great victory, why wasn't he happy? Why was he so peevish?
Right.
Why was he clearly so irritated? And of course, taking out that irritation on Jim Acosta. And I think you're right. I mean, there's so many lies with Donald Trump, but one of the biggest is this lie that he hates the media, whereas in fact, he's always loved the media going back to his days in New York with the tabloids. I mean, he is a complete media hound. He lives for media coverage, and he loves getting into these fights with people like Jim Acosta because he knows his base hates the media and riles them up. It's like a WWF spectacle.
Right.
And so that's what he's engaged in with Jim Acosta. But of course, you know, his followers fall for it. I mean, they don't see the artifice involved. And so they love how he's standing up to the so-called enemy of the people, poor Jim Acosta.
Right. Yeah. And you can see a little bit of Jim sort of getting into it and figure, all right, fine, I'm just going to go and stay with this. But then the White House did the thing that was a bit unprecedented, particularly, you know, talking to a number of reporters who said that they've never had that happen to him, where their White House press privileges were pulled. The White House comes out and says, well, that's because he touched the intern. Well, you look at the video. He didn't grab the intern. Yes, their arms touched because she was going for the microphone and he had his hand, the microphone in his hand. But it wasn't as Sarah Huckabee was stating it as if, you know, he tackled the poor girl to the floor or something. How does that play for the media? Does this thing get worse? I have a sense it does. I think the president wants it to for the very reasons you just said. How should the media respond to this? I mean, what do they do?
Those are great questions. I mean, I think it's disgusting what Trump is doing, whipping up hatred of the news media, and the way that Sarah Huckabee Sanders then released this doctored videotape from InfoWars from Alex Jones,
right,
purporting to show that Jim Acosta was grabbing this intern, which he clearly was not doing. I mean, this is like the Zapruder film or something. And this is all a giant distraction, A, from the fact that the Republicans lost the House, and B, from the fact that Trump just fired his attorney general because the attorney general would not stop an investigation of Donald Trump. I mean, that's the real news. But instead, you know, Trump is picking a fight with Jim Acosta because, as you say, it's going to be the bright, shiny object. So, you know, I think the press is in a dilemma. There's not an obvious way to respond to this because I think everybody feels compelled to stand up for Jim Acosta and freedom of the press and to protest this outrageous White House assault. But by doing that, they're sort of playing into Donald Trump's hands because this is the fight he wants to have.
Yeah. And you touched on the next topic I wanted to get into with you, and that is our forlorn and now forgotten Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was ousted yesterday after, which is the great fun for me, when the president's asked about Jeff Sessions, like, oh, no, Jeff's fine. I like Jeff. Good man. And then literally the next thing you know, the boy is being kicked to the curb. But he's out. And Matt Whitaker, his chief of staff, is now in. Now, Matt has been not once but on several occasions quoted as stating his opinion about the Mueller investigation, referring to it very much in Trumpian terms as a witch hunt, making note of the fact that one way to sort of deal with this rogue operation is to cut its funding. What should we expect from Whitaker at this point? And Jeff Sessions clearly would be a witness for Bob Mueller, but what does this mean for Mueller as well?
Well, this is a very worrisome and outrageous situation. I mean, I think we've kind of come to take it for granted that Donald Trump is going to engage in obstruction of justice and undermine the rule of law, but this should not become routine. I mean, this is something that I think should provoke more outrage than it does. And the kind of the problem with Trump is he says and does so many crazy things every day that you lose a sense of proportion. And so, you know, much of the media gets focused on Jim Acosta or something else and loses sight of what I think is more important, which is, in fact, that he has gotten rid of the attorney general as he previously got rid of the FBI director. basically to stop an investigation into himself. And now he's appointed this acolyte who, you know, has talked about how he wants to strangle the Mueller investigation. And now he is the acting attorney general. So, you know, we have to see what happens at this point. But you would hope that there would be bipartisan action in Congress to finally pass legislation to protect Robert Mueller and to make clear to Trump that if he tries to stop the investigation, this will be a cause for impeachment. But, you know, I don't have much hope that there, in fact, will be any kind of bipartisan action, because the Republicans have shown pretty consistently over the last couple of years that they're much more interested in protecting Donald Trump than they are in protecting the rule of law.
Which leads us to the book. It is The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right, by Max Boot. Highly recommend you pick it up. In the book, you warn about Trump, his presidency, how in many ways it presages America's decline. Talk a little bit about that. Clearly, the conversation we just had are elements of that, in terms, especially when it comes to the important and finer points of the rule of law and justice for all, and little things like the 14th Amendment and so forth. How do you see this period presaging something far worse to come?
Well, yeah, I think you may be right about something far worse to come. I mean, the book itself is basically a memoir. It tells the story of my life, how I became an American and a conservative. I was born in the Soviet Union, came here in 1976, you know, grew up as a Reagan conservative in Southern California in the 1980s, worked at the Wall Street Journal editorial page, wrote for commentary in the Weekly Standard, advised three Republican presidential candidates. Somebody who was, I was somebody who was a member of the conservative movement, a loyal Republican. I never voted for a Democrat in my life until I voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But then, as I recount in the book, the shock of Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party was too much for me. And the day after the election, I re-registered as an independent because I was so disgusted. And I remain so disgusted, not just with Trump, but with the fact that so many Republicans support him, even though he flies in the face of so much of what I, as a conservative, have always believed, and acts in ways that it's just impossible for me to imagine previous conservatives like Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush acting. You know, I think it's a very sorry state of affairs that he has transformed the Republican Party into his image. I think ultimately, in the long term, this is not going to be a successful strategy for Republicans because, you know, as you know, Michael, we're becoming a majority-minority nation by the 2040s. And, you know, after, as you also obviously know, after 2012, all the talk was that Republicans had to appeal to minorities.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump has gone in the exact opposite direction. He is making the Republican Party into essentially the white nationalist party. He is addressing, you know, the grievances of grumpy old white people who watch Fox News. And that's been a surprisingly successful strategy because those people vote at higher rates than minorities or young people do. But sooner or later, this strategy is going to fail in a spectacular way, and long after Donald Trump, of course, has gone from the White House.
So here's one for you. Have we, in an ironic twist, irony of ironies, have guys like you and me, I mean, because our narratives, even though you're from Russia and I'm from here, we're in the same space. You know, we're Reagan Republicans. We sort of came into this party grounded with some core ideas and vision. I call myself a Lincoln Republican. I take it back to the party's founding around this idea of individual liberties and individual rights, you know, the fight for folks to be American, starting with slavery and our long-held positions on immigration and the idea of assimilation as opposed to building walls. Have we become the villains in an ironic twist of this Trumpian narrative that where we stand is the bad space? We're the bad guys for wanting civility, for wanting, you know, we can be conservatives but still argue, make a center-right argument, you know, kind of deal. How do you see that? Because for me, I've got to what I did. I did a discussion recently, and I made a comment, and the gentleman reporter then said, well, the next time we have to go out and get ourselves a Republican to answer that question. And I was like, what the hell, bitch? What is your problem? You know, and I went off on the guy. And, you could tell the audience was like, oh, he probably shouldn't have said that, you know, because it's like, dude, you want to go through the list of, you know, my conservative credentials and what I've done and where I've been. But, you know, you have this new narrative now that unless you sound ignorant and stupid like Trump does on so many of these issues, and unless I'm trying to scare you into believing what I'm saying or just outright lying in your face, oh, then you're not a Republican. How did we get on this side of that coin?
That's a great question, Michael. I mean, believe me, I feel your pain. I feel it all the time because the Republican Party has become a cult of personality, and anybody who does not worship at the altar of Trump, it must not be a real Republican or a real conservative. And I hear that all the time, you know, on Twitter and elsewhere, where people say, "Oh, that boot is a leftist." You know,
right.
he's never been a Republican. He's never been a conservative. And I'm thinking, well, okay, maybe if I was a leftist, I did a pretty good job of hiding it throughout my life because I wrote for all the leading conservative publications in America. I advised 3 Republican presidential candidates, and nobody suspected I was actually a leftist. In fact, you know, I'm sure you're pretty much in the same boat as I am. My views have not changed that much. It's
nope.
The Republican Party
yep.
that has been transformed out of all recognition. And now they're redefining, you know, who's a conservative, who's a Republican. And the only standard now is where do you stand in relation to Trump? And if you're in favor of Trump, then you're a good conservative. And if you're opposed to him, then you're not a real conservative.
Well, what I appreciate about the corrosion of conservatism, one is its honesty. And two, it's insights about where we are and how we got here. It is not just a good read, folks. It's something, if you really want to understand what guys like Max and myself have been fighting about and talking about and writing about and pushing for many, many years, get a load of this one because it will lay it out for you with a degree of clarity that we don't have today, and certainly not coming out of the Republican Party today, because as you noted, Max, it's gotten compromised and it has willingly closed its eyes to its own history and blinded itself to its future. As you noted before, this country is browning. It is changing. And you can't avoid the demographic shifts. When you go through parts of the South and the Midwest, you find now as many Hispanics as you do white folks,
right.
and people of color. You know, African Americans are moving out of those central areas of New York and the Northeast and the Deep South, and they are spreading themselves across the country and taking ownership more and more of this great land that we should all be sharing and not be afraid of each other. But I love the way you do it. I love the way you tell the story, your own personal story. And I love how you've declared your dissent. Now, I have to admit, I'm still looking for some brothers to hang with me over here. You've already gone and left. Now, I may need to call on you from time to time to help a brother out as we try to right this elephant.
But, I know. It's a hard place to be to stay sane in today's Republican Party, right?
It is. But that had to be hard for you, too, to leave, you know, to sort of, you know, to step away. Now, the thing that I think folks need to understand about guys like yourself and my buddy Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace and a few others out there is they haven't left their principles, their conservative ideals and values anywhere. They've taken those with them. They've just said, I don't want to be in this construct. I don't want to be a part of this this storyline with these people behaving this way. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, absolutely, because Donald Trump has nothing to do with conservatism, as I understand it, and he is taking the name of conservatism and moving in a direction that I find alien and repugnant. I mean, he does have sort of a conservative lineage, but it's not one I want to be associated with, because his lineage is basically, you know, it's not Abraham Lincoln. It's more like John Calhoun. It's like George Wallace. It's Pat Buchanan. It's Joe McCarthy, people like that.
Right.
That's the conservatism that he's channeling. And that's a very different kind of conservatism from the kind you and I grew up with, like in the 1980s when it was Ronald Reagan, William F. Buckley, George Will, people like that. And I just can't stomach what's going on. And I try to hold to my beliefs, but I just find the Republican Party to be hostile to those beliefs now.
Well, I agree with that. And the fight continues because the cause still remains true. But I'm really glad, man, you took the time to stop by and chat with the Man of Steel a little bit about what we've seen happening over the last few weeks, but especially to share a thought or two about conservatism, what it really is, and certainly what it isn't. And again, I want to highly recommend to folks that you go out and get a copy of Max's book, The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. Max Booth, one of the best, man. We really appreciate you.
Thanks very much for having me on. And I greatly admire you, Michael, because, I mean, I've just been a scribe. I mean, you're somebody who was a former RNC chairman. For you to come out and oppose Trump in the way that you have, I think takes courage and integrity. And I really salute you for it.
Well, they don't call me the Man of Steel for nothing. I appreciate that very much. The one and only Max Boot. All right, folks, that about does it for us on this particular version of our podcast, The Man of Steel. Certainly, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out. It's always good stuff. And go back and listen to some of those episodes you may have also missed. Now, before we go, I do want to share with you one other thought. Many of you out there have families. You got kids and a mortgage. You know, the stuff, right? But you don't have life insurance. Why not? Well, you think you can't afford it. But let me tell you about John. Now, John is 35 and in pretty good shape. He's got a couple of life insurance quotes that he's looking at. And as you may suspect, they're outrageous. So he called SelectQuote at 1-800-394-8967. SelectQuote Comparison shops highly rated term life insurance companies across the country and give you a choice of your best rates. SelectQuote gave John the option of a $1 million policy for under $36 a month or a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. They get you better rates than by going directly to your insurers. No doubt about that. Now, you need to call them at 1-800-394-8967. That's 1-800-394-8967. Or you can go to selectquote.com. Now, here's the disclaimer. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states. We'll be back next time with more from the Man of Steel.